Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today are several important guests who have gathered in Albany for the International Conference on the Theory and Practice of Electronic Governance, a meeting at the University at Albany that brings together hundreds of technology and government experts from around the world. Joining us are Dr. Nigel Shadbolt, Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of Southampton and head of the Web and Internet Science Group, Dr. Jim Hendler, Chair of the Computer Science Department at RPI, in the Department of Computer Science and Cognitive Science, Gene Holm, Chief Knowledge Architect at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech and Chair of NASA's Knowledge Management Team, and Teresa Pardo, Director of the University at Albany Center for Technology in Government. Thank you all for being here. It's a great pleasure for us to host you. And Teresa Pardo, I wonder if you would start us off by telling us what this is all about.
Thank you, Alan. It's great to be here to talk with you today about what I think is really an amazing thing happening here in Albany. This week, the Center for Technology and Government at the University at Albany, as you said, is hosting the International Conference on Electronic Governance Theory and Practice. So what ICEGOV, as we call it, is about is bringing together academics, practitioners, civil society, the private sector, into a conversation that focuses on how technology and innovations in public policy, public management can make a difference in the lives of citizens all over the world. So we have 64 countries represented among the 400 folks who are here, and we're just really having a great time talking about things like open data, smart cities, open government, and many other topics, among them also women in technology and in the developing world. So we're here today to talk more about those topics.
What do you mean open data?
Open data, and I'd love to defer to some of my colleagues who are really world leaders in the conversation on open data. But open data, from my perspective, is a process. It's a thing. It's a way of bringing government data to citizens for their use in decision making, for understanding what's going on inside of government, to understand how they can improve the quality of their life. So, for example, weather data. Weather data is typically gathered by governments. Citizens are very familiar with the process of getting access to data about the weather. But what about other things like financial regulation, public health, other kinds of data sets that aren't so freely available to citizens? That's what open data is about, unlocking the data stores of government and making them available for citizens to use them, the corporate sector as well.
Now, we know that government talks a good game, but they're not always where they should be when the rubber hits the road. Dr. Shadbolt, I wonder if you could talk to that for a moment.
Well, it's an interesting idea, this notion that government should actually put out the data they collect at the taxpayers' expense. It's really interesting stuff, often spending what they spend our tax dollars or pounds on, exactly how well they're doing in healthcare delivery, how well they're doing in terms of crime clear-up. These sorts of issues, which are collected by government in the process of undertaking their public tasks, sits around very often with officials and administrators. But we've noticed that if you get that data out there, new sorts of applications are built, which governments never think of, that deliver real benefits. And in the UK, we've been working for the last 3 years on this, actually across governments. As you probably know, UK's got a pretty adversarial political system. And this is an idea that survived contact with an election, which changed the government. So there's probably something pretty interesting at the bottom of this.
Now, you're a professor of artificial intelligence. How does that play into all of this?
Well, that's an interesting story. It actually started about 10 years ago when those of us in AI didn't get the web until quite late. I have to say that, confess to it. We were all busy trying to build brains in boxes and, the kind of idea of robots and smart devices. But actually, the really interesting AI is a thing called augmented intelligence. And that's a new kind of thing we didn't foresee. It's the web. It's the fact that there are thousands and millions of us connected by the web, and together we can achieve really remarkable things together. And what if the web was treated also as if it was a large database? And essentially, government data is one part of that environment. Get government data out there. Smart people will do smart things with it in ways that will make public service better and maybe even make it smaller.
Well, now I notice you have a British or English accent, as we say. So I'm going to ask you a question. Which side of your political spectrum is more for open data than the other? Is the left more for it? Is the right more for it?
That's an interesting point. The fact it survived transition from a left to a centre-right coalition government suggests that actually the great thing about open data is the reasons you do it include improving public service delivery, accountability, transparency, increasing social capital, creating economic value. And depending which stripe of government you are, you can find reasons in that list that appeal to your particular political credo. So we think that actually open data works across the political spectrum. I think it's a bipartisan issue. I think it's hard to argue that we citizens shouldn't have access to the data collected in our name.
Well, very well said. Nevertheless, in practicality, is a Maggie Thatcher, who was a controlly lady, was more likely to like your concept than, you know, somebody from the left who might believe in, you know, the populi more than some of the others?
Well, I think we've not seen that. We've seen, for example, that a left-leaning government might be much more interested in improving data in public service delivery by having, for example, in the UK, the infection rates in our hospitals, you know, hospital-acquired infections were pretty bad news.
Sure.
They began to release the data across all hospitals, publish league tables of who was doing well, who was doing badly. We've had an 85% decrease in hospital-acquired infection in the UK in 2 years.
How does that work? I mean, you still got the bug in the hospital, don't
well,
you?
Yeah, but some people do really well and some people do really badly. And what you get in this process of producing league tables is the people at the bottom asking the people at the top of the league, how do you do that? So sharing best practice is one of the ways in which data releases help. Uh-huh, and that works across the political spectrum. If you're a free market capitalist, you probably want to get hold of that data the government's holding to work out how you can actually do better business intelligence over what government buys and procures.
Yeah. And I suppose if somebody wants to avoid the MRSA bug, they might be more likely not to go to a hospital which has a high rate.
Exactly so. Yeah, it kind of increases choice too. Maybe, why not?
Right. Mm. Gene Holm, co-chair of Government Interest Group at W3C, chief knowledge architect at the Jet Propulsion Lab of NASA. How do you fit into this?
I'm actually on loan to the White House right now as the evangelist for data.gov, which is an open data platform for the U.S. government. So we have 180 agencies across the government sharing over 400,000 data sets, which we try to get into the hands of developers and innovators and small business owners so that they can benefit from this government data, research, and capabilities that we've developed over time.
This is obviously a political use of this concept, which is politics being authoritative allocation of scarce resources. This is a pretty scarce resource information, isn't it?
Well, data in and of itself is collected all over the government, and we collect it for our own purposes, whether it's for tax, you know, working taxes, or at NASA, for example, we collect data from the spacecraft. That data collection has normally been used for creating reports and doing analysis and scientific study. But really, once we open it up in ways that people can access and understand, we're able to put it into the hands of citizens and small businesses to be able to make better benefits and to use it in ways we could never imagine.
Do we have any idea whether that's working?
Yeah, we do. So on data.gov, we have a variety of communities that we've developed around key areas for energy, for health, for manufacturing and business. And in each of those areas, we work with people across the communities, across the nation, and sometimes with international partners like our folks at data.gov UK, to look at how we can change things for people. So Nigel mentioned how hospitals are changing their infection rates and their ways of responding to illnesses. We're also seeing applications coming out on smartphones by small businesses and new startups like iTriage and Asmopolis that are helping people with specific diseases get better treatments every day.
What are those?
So Asmopolis is a really interesting application, and the people with asthma, as you know, use inhalers. So they put a small GPS-enabled chip in the inhaler, and every time you have an asthma issue, you push the inhaler and it geolocates where you are. So at the end of a month of doing this with your doctor, it shows you a map that says these are the places where I'm having asthma attacks, and you can then make a choice to avoid it. In the first 6 months of implementation of this, people who had a daily incidence rate of 65% of asthma attacks went down to 25% with just the knowledge of that difference.
Oh, what was the other one?
And the other one is called iTriage, a very interesting application developed by two emergency room doctors. And they decided that it would be more effective if people knew when they had strange and odd symptoms, when they could go to the emergency room, and when they could wait and just do home therapy or go to their doctor. So you enter symptoms, and you just have it on your smartphone.
For example, a symptom.
So a symptom might be chest pain. But chest pain, often people would think, this is an important thing. But jaw pain, for example, jaw pain that starts to radiate out, a lot of people don't realize that's an early symptom, often, of a heart attack. And so, in fact, there was just that example for a gentleman about a month ago that I was talking with the eye triage doctors. And he put in that symptom. It said, you should go immediately to an emergency room. And he got there in time for them to give him the medication to help avert the heart attack, and it saved his life. In 2.5 years of eye triage, they have treated 7 million patients.
No.
Yes.
That's
amazing.
That's a lot of people.
It's a huge amount of people.
Yeah. Yeah. At this conference, is there anybody you disagree with who has presented at the ICE conference?
I think it's really interesting because part of ICEGOV's difference from a lot of other conferences is that...
Just remind us what ICEGOV is again.
The International Conference on the Theory and Practice of Electronic Governance.
Great. Thank ICEGOV. You. Thank you, Teresa.
You're welcome. Yeah.
So what ICEGOV does is it brings together the practitioners, which often have other venues to come together, but also with the academicians. So we have a chance to really learn from researchers across the world. As said was before, we had 64 countries represented this week here in Albany. And so the idea of being able to really ground the kind of work that Nigel and I and Jim are doing in fundamental research and understand how to measure the improvements of that over time and new technologies and how we can implement that is a really interesting and exciting opportunity for us.
I'm sorry for making you monopolize this, but I have one more question. You work in the White House. Do we know that there are differences between the Republicans and the Democrats when it comes to sharing information?
Well, I think Nigel sort of nailed it, where it's really an apolitical issue. And I'm not trying to skate through something here, but the fact is that it really doesn't have to do with politics. It has to do with the idea of whether or not the government data that taxpayers pay for should be made available to them, both as individual citizens and also to help American businesses. So both sides of the aisle, as far as I can tell, really agree on the idea of opening up data. And both President Obama has supported this and as part of his national action plan. And Daryl Issa is one of our strongest supporters, a Republican congressman in California.
I want to remind the panel that they are welcome to jump in when you hear something that you didn't like that, or something that you agree with that you want to say. Okay, with that, let's go to Dr. Jim Hendler, the chair of computer science at RPI. Okay, so how do you come into this? A major engineering institution like RPI obviously gets very interested in when something of this type starts to emerge.
So I actually came into government sort of through the data side. So I'm really what nowadays people are calling a data scientist or a web scientist, but someone who really is interested in what Nigel talked about, the bringing all of this stuff together on the web. So on the web, a document can point at another document, but really hard for data to point at other data. So there's all these terms like linked data and stuff, but nowadays you've heard the phrase big data. So you want to bring things together from a lot of different places and say, what is this telling us? If I want to understand if the government is working, are we doing something appropriate? What information do I bring together? How do I get it? And then I'm particularly interested in doing that not only on the U.S. Side. I do, as Gene does, work for the DataGov project a little bit, but I'm interested in really doing that internationally. How do we bring the data that Nigel is releasing in England and the data that we're releasing in the U.S. together? They're in different formats. They're organized differently. They're the way things are reported. So if we count just the raw number of burglaries in the safest part of England as reported and the burglaries in the worst part of the U.S. as reported, it actually makes England look worse. But of course, what's really happening there is they report all of them. We report only felonies and only above a certain amount. So you have to know these things. You have to figure out how do we put that information out there? How do we get people, when they make these data applications, say, here's how we make it really work. Here's what's causing this kind of data to come together with this data appropriately. How do we see it? How do we visualize it? So when you open the New York Times or the Albany Times Union, you see one of those nice little infographics that says this is what's happening over time in somebody's budget, or, you know, this is the number of things that we've been seeing. What if you wanted to do that yourself? How do we get those kind of technologies out there? So the engineering challenge to this is how do we take the technologies that are right now only really available to the top scientists and people with top computers, and how do we start bringing that into a world where people can do it on the smartphone with their own data? They can be the one who creates the information graphics that they care about, that sort of thing.
I recently read a story about a Nobel Prize winner, and two guys got it, and the third guy who was also there didn't get it. Now, this is a long way around to tell you that the FBI and the CIA compete with each other, you know, for credit and information. When you're dealing with universities, obviously, there's got to be some of that, isn't there?
Well, there's a lot of different issues here. So a conference like ICEGOV gives us a place to put publications. Other people read them. One of the things you get credit for as a professor is sharing.
Indeed.
So we're actually a community that's used to being open and sharing. So open data doesn't threaten us the way some government agencies get very nervous and, you know, we've always owned this. Why should we give it away?
Well, no, but I'm talking about an advance of knowledge in which somebody comes up with something new. Are you sure you want to share that with your colleagues who may grab it and get the credit for it?
You know, there's always an issue there. In fact, one of the interesting things in this open data thing is who gets credit for the data? How do you keep track of whether it was produced by the CIA or the FBI? Mm-hmm. Right now, that stuff shows up in a newspaper with a little picture. It doesn't say this is where the data came from and who produced it and where it came from. We can actually put into the infrastructure stuff that keeps track of more of that. So when you want to know, should I trust this data, you can know where it came from, things like that. So the sharing of data, the citation of data, is like citations of papers. We publish quite widely to share information. And occasionally you're inventing something. You'll want to make sure you get a patent or such before you share it. But science works by the sharing of information, not by the hiding of it.
Now, Dr. Shadbolt, I noticed that when I asked that question of Jim Handler, you sort of nodded your head. And I wondered if there was something I should follow up with.
Well, I was loath to leap in too ferociously, but it seems to me that actually we do understand that all sorts of human activities are conditioned around, if you like, we're talking about trying to share information out. But of course, we know that lots of business and lots of human affairs are governed by precisely what I might think of as information asymmetry. I know something you don't, okay? And the real issue is when it's in the public interest to level the playing field and when actually you want to protect. And that was to your point about IP protection. It won't be the case that every piece of single discovery is something you immediately throw over the fence. But the general issue around collaboration, that this gets you more benefit, it's one of the challenges we're finding in releasing this stuff out of government. I mean, a number of governments will charge. They have nice little kind of local businesses with inside bits of government that charge for the data. And you're suddenly saying, put it out there free, because actually, believe us, there'll be wider economic benefit by more people getting it than your little kind of local economic benefit in your department. But we don't really have the economic analysis to prove that just yet. And that's going to be one of the really interesting developments, I think, in the research field. And also, economists have got to get smart to this new world where the value of stuff is not in its scarcity, not in the scarcity of information, but the fact that there's more of it around and more of it out there. And how do you account for that?
So if I could go to government and ask them in the UK any question I wanted, I'd ask, what proportion of the population's first name is Nigel? Because everybody from there that I've never met is, how many can there be in one place?
Well, it's a remarkable thing because I used to think it was a rather scarce name, but it's as common as chips. It turns out there is a data set which is precisely an enumeration of the frequency of Christian names in the UK. And it's it's one of those data sets everybody's interested in, of course. I mean, the government will know an awful lot about you. In fact, that's one of the interesting areas as we move from the idea of non-personal open data. So I can tell you great stories in the UK of my favorite is the bus stops. Where are the bus stops in the UK? Well, it turned out the government knew where they were. There were 360,000 of them. And it wasn't very interested in telling people where they were, interestingly enough. So it took us a long time to get the data published. When it was published, how many of those bus stops do you imagine weren't where the government thought they were? Well, it was tens of thousands. You know, had they gone missing? Had they moved? Data is never complete and accurate. And so one of the benefits of publishing this stuff out is that people, the term is crowdsourcing, people improve it because they know where this stuff has gone. And actually then you can get an improvement on the data the state holds to a level.
Fascinating. Obviously, the media, which I'm terribly interested in, is a transmission belt of this information.
Yeah, yeah.
So somebody's got to mine it, obviously. But then when you put it together, it becomes of interest to the media. For example, what you just said about Nigel.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating because every year One of the great sweepstakes here in the United States is what's the most popular first name? How do you avoid the trivial, which the newspapers obviously always want, as opposed to what's important? Anybody?
Well, data journalism, just to say, data journalism is going to be one of the big consumers of open data. And of course,
what is data journalism?
Data journalism is using data assets to go and look for the story. And of course, journalists have always done that. They've tended to do it following their intuition, but now they've got tons of stuff. In fact, one of the complaints has been that they're hiding all the interesting stuff in plain sight by releasing so much data you can't see where the real value is. But don't you worry. In the UK, journalists find out where the spending data points to some piece of frivolous spending in public government. And of course, that generates stories. And I think the thing that I think is important for all of us to be concerned about is how we, just because the data's there doesn't mean we shouldn't have a conversation around whether its interpretation is reasonable or not. And journalists, of course, always get their own spin on data. Scientists are completely above that, of course.
Well, yeah, but it raises one other question. I want to get to Teresa Pardo, but I wanted to ask you one question, and that is that we just saw Rupert Murdoch and his troubles and the Parliament investigating him and all the rest of it over there. So
an American citizen, Rupert Murdoch.
Rupert Murdoch. But who knows for how long? That does bring up, in my mind, the question of what you would call privacy and I would call privacy, and whether or not this release of all this data gives us a tough go.
It's a very important point that even when it's non-personal, anonymized data, all this data together gives you an exquisite profile over people and demographies and populations. And in fact, I think that is something we have to be mindful of. And just because the data is there doesn't mean anybody has a right to just use it to invade your privacy. But this area will be a hugely important one to understand, because it would be very sad if unintended releases that allow you to de-anonymize data sets suddenly slam the whole process into reverse.
Well, is that something to worry about?
I think it's something we have to be vigilant about. So I think one of the things we've got in the UK, and I'm sure in the US, is a process by which we look to see whether data sets, which might be innocuous at one level, when released with others, do actually lead to this de-anonymization.
So if you do AIDS research, the question then becomes, is somebody's name going to leak out as a result of this?
Yeah. Although, you know, we say all of that. Of course, companies have been doing segmentation, profiling, advertising to you for tens of years, you know, and they've got it off to a fine art. So they might not know exactly what your name is, but they know everything about your buying habit and your demographic and your profile. But in this world of a large amount of data, the issue you speak to is a very important one.
Jim Hender, sure.
Let me just quickly say, one of the issues we are actually very concerned about, Nigel and I have been talking about, and we were presenting it at this conference, is what happens internationally. Because when the Brits release something, and we release something, and the Norwegians release something, they're not typically going to identify a particular person, but they may identify things that one or more of those countries might not want to share. Mm-hmm. They may have trends that are interesting to one but not to another. There may be issues about, is the data comparable? So one of the hard issues is, now that there's over a million data sets from around the world that we can find and touch, and we actually have a catalog of all those, we can actually start saying, what could happen? What happens if you mix these things together? When you have a million types of data in from 192 different places around the world, you know, what new things happen, good and bad?
Mm-hmm. Unintended consequences. Teresa Pardo.
See, I think you raise a number of really interesting questions. I think one of the ones from the earlier conversation is what I would characterize as the question, what do citizens want? Right? And so how do we begin to understand what citizens want? And what are the implications of their interests and putting their interests together in data? And I think a lot of the folks that are here this week at ICEGOV, the research community, what we bring to the table in this conversation is the ability to study those questions. How do we understand when, in fact, the consequences might be unexpected or expected, and whether they're positive or negative? How do we understand how the implications of the kinds of data access programs that are being talked about here? What is the new role of government, and how do we understand the kinds of things that government students who are preparing for careers in government, what do they need to know now that they didn't know before? How do they work with web scientists, with data scientists, with civil society in new ways to understand the power of data and to make it possible for governments to actually live up to the expectations that citizens have. So the research community that's here is, I think, working very closely with the folks who are on this panel to try and understand those questions, to understand what kind of institutions do we have to create, what kind of public policies make sense, how do the public policies enable, and to what extent do they limit the potential of data access. And I think data access, to me, translates into creating public value. How do we ensure that public value is created by all the investments that are being made in data access? And whether it's here in the U.S. or in places like Nepal, Oman, we heard yesterday from one of the members of the IT organization for the government of Oman, and they're talking about how they're investing in new technologies, new strategies to make data available to the citizens in Oman, Nepal, Colombia, all over the world. Governments are trying to figure this out and to try and make comparative analysis. What has value to citizens in Colombia? What has value to citizens in Albany? The answer to those questions are very, very different. We have to be very careful to understand the context within which we're making data available. And that's why I think this interdisciplinary community, this interdisciplinary conversation is so important. We have computer scientists, we have artificial intelligence and cognitive scientists, we have social scientists like myself, and many others who are critical to come together into this conversation.
Jean Holm, to my mind, there comes the word democracy as I listen to this. And some of the places that Teresa Pardo just mentioned are anything but democratic. So do we want to understand that the release of data could be symbolic for the release of a lot more, you know, once you do that for a society that is repressed?
So I think that different governments are attempting to look at open data in different ways. The W3C e-government interest group I lead has member nations from all over the world, from all sorts of different government paradigms. And from my perspective, the idea that a government is willing to open up any data is a great first step. So I don't sort of hold it against a government that they're not releasing hundreds of thousands of data sets or even just a lot of very high quality data sets as the DataGov UK approaches. But really the data sets that they're able to release that are accurate and that start that movement towards letting the citizens understand their government and perhaps have a voice in how that government is managed and overseen.
Yes, but obviously I saw Nigel again nodding his head when we started to talk about this. This has some serious implications for whether the Prince of Saudi Arabia wants to send a signal that we're going to be in a more open government.
Yeah, I think actually this is a pretty disruptive movement at one level, and that's good in lots of ways. It seems to me putting citizens at the center of this, or consumers at the center of this process, and in many cases saying if government publishes its data and gets out of the way, actually folk are very bright at building new apps and doing new clever things with that
some
data.
Some folks. Kids in the United States don't know where the Pacific Ocean is.
Maybe that's true, but yeah. There are an awful lot of people who can code for America. Lots of these efforts where people will do really dramatic things with data, some of which are better than the things that government itself can think to do with the data. And governments can spend a lot of money, not always to best effect, on big IT systems. So I think there is here something very, very interesting around the core values of data back to individual citizens and consumers. And in fact, we've talked about open data here today, about the kind of non-personal data that governments hold about us. But there's also a really interesting movement here called Smart Disclosure. In the UK, we call it My Data, which is giving access back to consumers and citizens the data that states and businesses hold on them. Because whose data is it? You know, whether it's your health records or your tax records, your welfare, your educational transcript, the stuff that telcos have on you and the retail high street, all that data is kind of at the moment held by states and businesses. But what if we could get access to that? And that's a really interesting new movement. So I'm quite hopeful of the fact that this whole approach, that data is a disruptor, and whether you believe it favors open or closed forms of government, it will disrupt.
And pulling it back to the U.S. context, and I admit in the interest of full disclosure, I run an organization called Computer Scientists for Obama, but the Obama administration actually thought very much like you did and has created an organization, an Open Government Partnership, which is really aimed at getting democracies originally and now countries from all over the world to come together and make commitments to how they're going to share data. It's a new, in the old days, we used to say containment was getting the democracies to talk together and to say, these are the things we share. Human rights is one of our values. Data rights has become one of the values that we now, as a government, have said is something we'd like to see more of. We believe that this data sharing, that this opening of government, that this providing of transparency around the world is really a key aspect of modern democracy.
So first of all, I want to go to Teresa Pardo, who is going to reintroduce what we are doing here for those people who have been just turning their radios on. Go ahead, Teresa.
Sure. We're here with a group of the key speakers from the International Conference on the Theory and Practice of Electronic Governance. And I think the conversation that we're having is about open data and the significance, the challenges, the opportunities that are represented in the ideas of open data.
Okay, so I want to go to another place. We know that there are thousands of nuclear warheads all over the world. So obviously, there are some things you don't want to share with everybody. And who makes those decisions about what gets shared and what doesn't?
So,
Jean Holm, yes.
From the U.S. perspective. So on data.gov, which is the primary area where we release this information to the public, there are two layers of approvals for any kind of data that gets released. The first occurs at the agency that actually has gathered and owns that data. So for nuclear information, for example, it could be the Missile Defense Agency or the Department of Defense. They go through their own internal appropriate clearances to say that this is ready to release to the public. So they have gone through, in the case of nuclear data, a lot of information about whether or not that's appropriate to approve. However, once it gets to data.gov, we actually have a member of the National Security Council that we work with because there's a mosaic effect that sometimes happens, where perhaps the Missile Defense Agency and NASA have both released information that they think is okay, but together it reveals something that as a national security interest, we wouldn't want it to be revealed. So we actually do a secondary check for primarily two things. One is national security, and the second is our citizens' privacy. So if we think about education data, Wyoming is a very rural state. And there are some school districts and schools within Wyoming that have a very small student population. So if we're identifying students that may have special needs or are under school lunch programs that have special financial needs, it might be really clear when you combine that school data with other information exactly who we're talking about. So as Nigel mentioned earlier, we sometimes anonymize the data in that case. So we still release the...
Wait a second. When I hear a word, I always like to ask what it means. What does anonymize
mean? Anonymize means that instead of telling you it's just for the local middle school here, we're going to combine that with other middle schools and say this is for 4 or 5 schools, to the point at which it's not going to identify a specific or potentially specific individual. So we'll still release the information, but it may not have the same sort of specificity by which it might reveal some personal information about one of our citizens.
Teresa Pardo, one second, just let me ask this. We do know that we have found that millions of documents remain classified in agencies that shouldn't be. Just for the hell of it, you know, nobody wants to declassify. So how do you get around that sort of possessiveness? Teresa Pardo?
Well, there's lots of ways, and I'll just tell you one story from our opening keynote yesterday morning from David Ferriero, who's the archivist of the United States, the 10th archivist of the United States of America, opened the conference for us. And his opening presentation talked about exactly this issue, the process of declassifying documents and making them available to the public and understanding that process. What does it look like? How is it carried out in the interests of citizens? And so we talked about several really interesting sets of documents that are now available on the National Archives website that weren't previously available. And he talked about that process of declassification, which is actually quite complex, but they're really very, very committed to making more documents available through that declassification process. And I think the other thing that David mentioned that I think is a really critical statement to kind of reintroduce into this conversation is the the critical role or the critical responsibility that government plays in managing its records, right? Collecting data, managing that data, making sure it's available for becoming, for as a resource for citizens, and as we've talked about it here, for the corporate sector, et cetera. And so that responsibility that government has to be good stewards of information, which is a responsibility that they've always had, and now the nature of that responsibility is changing. You talk to people like Bob Freeman, of course, and the Committee on Open Government here in New York, and how they think about information access and open information. All of this rests on our ability in government to do a really good job managing our records. And I think that's an important conversation to have as part of this larger conversation as well.
Well, indeed, except that I know an awful lot about New York State government and COPAR, and I know that with some regularity, people say no, and then sometimes if it's politically close to the vest, even Bob Freeman, a great hero for all of us, will say, no, you're not entitled to that. So the question for all of you is there an appeal process from whence you come so that you get a whistleblower who says, I want this stuff and they won't give it to me? And is there somebody who you go to who tells you, okay, you're entitled to it?
Yeah, well, in the UK, actually, that's an interesting point. The notion of a right to data, so many countries have various forms of Freedom of Information Act, and actually one of the tests in trying to think about resetting the dial here on what officials think they should be doing is to say, if you would give that information out under a Freedom of Information request, why aren't you publishing it openly anyway? And in fact, the cost and burden of servicing FOI requests is quite significant, Freedom of Information requests, quite significant. A number of organizations in the UK have found that by publishing the stuff routinely and openly, they're taking a lot of costs out just on that Freedom of Information servicing. If, I think, we get to issues where there's contested data, so people are saying, you know, we should have this, why can't we get it? Then I think different jurisdictions are going to have different appeals processes. We have an information commissioner's office in the UK where you can go and take these kinds of appeals to. I think we will need to see the emergence of a new kind of governance to take exactly this kind of issue into account. But the real question is, can we change behavior? Can we change the presumption to be that this stuff is public and it's a public good to have it publicly published?
You know, this is very interesting stuff. I have seen situations in which you want the best for society and you say, here's the rules and it's going to be open government and the rest of it. And then you get some no good Nick who comes along and is the first and only one to bother everybody for the information. That's a sort of human nature sometime, and I wonder if anybody wants to talk about it, Teresa.
Well, I don't know if this speaks directly to that, but I think we can make it. When we start to talk about freedom of information requests, I think we begin also to move into the territory where we have to think about sort of types of data, categories of data. So where we see a lot of our freedom of information requests are not necessarily on administrative data only. Right? So there's administrative data that's collected through the process of governing. We have data sets about human services delivery. We have data sets about public health, DMV. But where we also get a lot of our freedom of information requests are in email traffic. Right. So you said what to whom, about what, and how the decision processes are carried out. And so I think as we think about open data and we think about the kind of, as we call them, the citizens against virtually everything, a cave. Right. So if you have a citizen who is looking for data that has a different character, it's not about an administrative process, but it's potentially about an email exchange among leadership. Those are different kinds of things that would have to be considered differently in terms of freedom of information, and that's where people like Bob and others weigh in. So I think when we think about open data, we have to understand what kind of data are we talking about when we talk about making it available openly and regularly to citizens and other important actors.
Doing what the citizens request is often an interesting question. One of the stories Dave Ferrer, the archivist, told us at the conference yesterday was what the main requests were for declassification. And it starts with important World War II documents, but the second most requested was all the government information on the Kennedy assassination. And the third one, of course, was UFOs.
Sure.
So, again, government... But those are citizens, and they are requesting things, and it is government data. So,
well,
so
that's so
finding
nice.
The
Jim,
right
let me
level
fight with you. Let me fight with
things.
You about that.
Sure.
I know a guy in a locality. I'm not going to say where, but let's just say it's in the Berkshires where I live, who decided he was going to pay pain in the rear. And every day he went down and made another Freedom of Information request just to drive them crazy. Well, they had to put on another clerk just in order to satisfy this guy. And he wasn't a nice guy from doing what he was doing.
So in the USA, they estimated the chief information officer of the United States is previously was Vivek Kundra. And he did a report where he estimated that the entire cost of the open government effort of the first year could be recovered just by the reduction in Freedom of Information Act requests to the U.S. government, because they were giving away all the things that somebody like that had to come try to find. And then you have there's many other data sets that haven't been released. There are real Freedom of Information issues. But a lot of that annoying stuff goes away when somebody comes in and you say, I don't need another clerk. It's right there on our website.
I think to your point,
Nigel and then Teresa.
I think to your point, Alan, is that we also, because we're in favor of open data, doesn't mean we're against private political dialogue. And actually, there's something really important in preserving a space where people can talk confidentially about issues. And we've actually had a rather famous example just in the last week in the UK where correspondence between our heir to the throne, Prince Charles, and ministers of state has been determined to be off limits, not going to be published openly. Now, some people think it should have been, other people don't. But I think there will always need to be cases where these judgments are carefully made, because if people know they're going to be immediately on the record, all of this stuff is going to be paraded, you simply won't get certain sorts of political consensus forming.
Nigel Stradwell, have you ever been in government?
No, I've observed it from the side. I've been a close and interested observer, more than I had ever thought in the last 3 years, I have
point,
to say.
So, point being, when you're it always feels differently than when you're conceptually looking at it, you know, from the outside. Teresa Pardo.
So I think this is also a good opportunity to talk maybe about your hometown in the Berkshires and a lot of other governments, both in New York and in the larger U.S. and around the world, who don't have records that were born digital. So they're not in electronic form.
Right?
So we have to remember that not everyone in the world, not every government has the capability, has the technology, the resources to make all of their records available in electronic form.
But that's changing, isn't it?
It is changing, and many of them are trying to do that. I've been spending lots of conversations with folks, heading to Nigeria in a couple weeks, met with Moldova several months ago, with many governments in the state of New York who, because of lots of reasons, rarely because that's the way they want it to be, are still collecting data on clipboards and bringing it back to the office and hoping that someone will have time to do data entry into a system so that that data becomes available in electronic form. So we part of the sort of the tail end, if you will, is the reality that not everyone is in the same situation with respect to their capability to engage in electronic access, open access to government. But I think fewer and fewer people are arguing against the logic and the value of doing that. But the capability is a different issue.
I was fascinated before in our earlier discussion when we started talking about the one in one makes 10. In other words, somebody puts out a certain amount of information. We think that it's benign. Somebody else puts out another set. We think that that's benign. But when they're combined, they bubble over the test tube. Can somebody give me an example of one of those places that that might have happened? Jim Hadler?
I'll give you a simple one that happened early in data.gov. We had one data set, which was just hiking trails in the U.S., right? And particularly one of the and another data set that was locations of nuclear plants. And during the past decade, we've felt maybe we don't want to make it easy for people to know what public paths are very close to nuclear plants. Mm-hmm. So what they did in that case is they made it so that the plant information is now reported kind of, it's not exactly where it is on the map. So it puts it in the same, puts it in the center of the zip code, essentially.
I had a friend when I was growing up, Jim, who knew everything, of course, and who was 12 years old, and who claimed that the reason we could never get the weather right is that they didn't want the Russians to know what the weather was going to be like. Everybody has a friend like that. We all know it. So, in fact, this may lead to misinformation based on what you're telling us. In other words, they changed where the nuclear plant
might be. Well, the key is the data when released said, this is the zip code of the nuclear plant, instead of saying this is the address of the nuclear plant. Mm-hmm. Now you can't put it on the same map exactly and see exactly where those things are without a lot more work. And, of course, there are people who can do that work. We now have more and more tools out there. So this is also a slippery sort of a slippery slope. What you can do today may not be what you can do tomorrow when you have better tools. And part of what we as the technology community, as in any new technology, it's our job to both create those new technologies, but also explore what they can do, both good and bad.
Now, Gene Holmes, sitting up there in the White House next to President Obama, I had this question for you, and that is this kind of sensitivity something that you deal with?
So the sensitivity, I think, of course, of both the citizens' private data as well as the national security of data, and a particular emphasis on both making sure that an agency, when they release the data, has embedded processes for what they need to clear and approve. And most agencies in the U.S. government have long had traditional processes for paper documents. And over the last 10 years or so have modified those for the electronic era. Because information gets released not only, of course, in traditional publications and formats, but also over social media. So one of the ways we try to engage citizens and try to understand what they're asking for is over Twitter and Facebook and Google+ and LinkedIn and a variety of other methods. And although there continues to be a digital divide here in America, as you pointed out, it's lessening. People may not have access to the internet, but they might have access to, you know, information on a smartphone or text information. We're working right now on a partnership with the government of India, where we're working with developing nations to help them also address the same issue. So we've released the code for data.gov, the actual software code on which we run, in partnership with India, the world's largest democracy and the world's oldest democracy. And we're working right now with the governments of Ghana and Rwanda, who are interested in trying to have more transparency and access to data for their citizens. We're helping them to build up this code. It's available to anybody in the world. And that code is helping them leap forward and not have that huge infrastructure cost and the complexity of the technology so that they can really focus on the release of that data and what it means for their citizens.
We have about 9 minutes left in this very fast-moving discussion, and I appreciate all of your doing this. But I wondered if each of you could just take a moment to say one thing about a perplexing issue that you hope gets worked out by these conferences. It seems to me that might be a good way to proceed. You're all looking blank at me and thinking, you know, we've all taught, and we know that what that look means. But Gina Holm, maybe you raise your hand. You want to go first?
Right. So one issue that's come up over and over again at the conference, and one that I think Nigel and I both are wrestling with right now, is measuring the economic value of the open data. So we all have these great anecdotes and stories. And I can point to you Brightscope and iTriage and Asmopolis as startup companies that are, you know, creating new jobs and great value for the American citizens built on this open data. But to be able to do it sort of nationally and say a release of a data set like this is going to drive this kind of economic value, unless we reach back to looking at weather data and GPS, which are great examples of paradigm shifts in the release of government data. Both of those have multi-billion dollar industries that they help to empower. Now we're really looking for the next thing. Perhaps it's vehicle data as we move to smart cars. Perhaps it's home energy data, which we actually have worked with utilities in California so that 21 million households can download their historical energy usage and use that in interesting ways to figure out whether they should install solar panels or how they can save money on their home energy heating. But how do we actually rigorously measure the economic value of the release of those data sets so that a government can be more strategic in making sure they're releasing the right data for economic development and that small businesses can figure out how they're going to build on that data?
I would also like to see how you could monetize it so we don't have to pay that much in taxes. Make them pay something. Nigel?
No, I think Gene's touched on a really important issue. In fact, in the UK, one of my current roles is as chairman of a thing called the Open Data Institute, which has been set up precisely to try and find the value in open data. So since we're releasing so much of it, where is the economic value? And actually, I think it goes deeper than this. I suspect that we won't maintain a really healthy supply of open data unless there's a demand side, unless there are companies and businesses whose businesses depend on this stuff. And a great example, the GPS signal, when it was released for commercial reuse, generated huge amounts of value. And we think that's the same in the UK for whole sets of data that are about to be and are being released. Good example in our system is our health data. Because we have a national health system, we're able to release data sets.
Lucky you.
Well, there you go. We have one. We regard it as a bit of a treasure, actually. It's always interesting because it has huge amounts of value. And the data set that's just being released is all the prescriptions that GPs write every month for the drugs they prescribe. Now, that is a fantastic resource look at.
Because also we know that certain drugs, because they don't monetize well, have been dropped by some of these companies.
And this is absolutely true. And one would like to see, if you like, the zip code variation on that and just how that works. So I think these are really interesting areas where looking at the economic value and generating economic value will be, and getting the evidence case will be a really hot topic.
Jim Hendler?
So I'm going to take it in a very different direction. Sure. I work at a university, RPI, where our slogan is, why not change the world? And I think this stuff really will change the world, and I want to keep that focus at that international level. Again, we have millions of data sets starting to be released. That's just by the governments, and when you add all the other things that go with that, the scientific data sets that have been funded by governments, the many things that affect our lives that we could have back, and the ability to analyze and look at that, compare, if we can find other countries that match us in certain ways and are doing something better, then we can start saying, hey, maybe we could do that too. So I think that, you know, I don't know who's going to be the Google or the Facebook of the future of this linked data web, but we know that that's going to be happening. We know more and more of this stuff is coming online. And to me, the most exciting thing is that there's just this whole new world of data that's just starting to open up to us.
Yeah. Teresa Pardo?
So I'll pick up on the university identity, because I have that as well, being part of Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy here at the University of Albany as well, as with CTG. And one of the things that we focus on a lot, in addition to trying to make the world within reach, which is our slogan across the river here, is to work with the cities and the state government, local governments throughout the state of New York. And creating new capability is the thing that we spend a lot of our time in, focused on at CTG. So how do we take these amazing ideas that our colleagues here are working on, the amazing systems that have been produced, and bring those to the local communities, whether it's in New York, again, or anywhere around the world? How do we make it possible for cities and towns and villages to leverage the data assets that they have? What are the kinds of capabilities that they need? So we study that, both as academics, but as applied research scientists, we bring those lessons into the practice of government through the relationships we have here. And I think it's very, very critical for us to understand that the mechanisms for institution building, for capability development, have to be part of the conversation in open data. How do we take this potential value proposition and ensure that our governments at all levels, all over the world, have the assets, have the resources that they need to make this possible?
And as a political scientist, I can tell you I know full well that the governor of New York has incentivized all of its campuses to do exactly that, so that these university centers will be, you know, economic engines. The problem, of course, becomes, well, there are lots of problems, and we'll discuss that the next time we all get together. Anyway, our guests have been Dr. Nigel Shadbolt, Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of Southampton and Head of the Web and Internet Science Group, Dr. Jim Hendler, Chair of Computer Science at RPI. In the Department of Computer Science and Cognitive Science, Gene Holm, Chief Knowledge Architect at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech, Chair of NASA's Knowledge Management Team on assignment at the White House, and Teresa Pardo, Director of the University of Albany Center for Technology and Government. I can't thank you all enough for being here. It was a great hour. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.